I look sometimes at some of the stuff I wrote when I was like younger and trying to deal with coming out and being gay, and normal was definitely the word. You know, I don't want to be gay, I want to be normal.
Hello, my name is Kay Anderson, and if you can't tell already, I have a bit of a cold, so I'm going to try and battle on and see how we get going. Anyway, this is Lost Spaces, the podcast that mourns the death of queer nightlife. Every episode, I talk to a different person about a venue from their past, the memories that they created there, and the people that they used to know. So, if you are a long-time listener of this show, you probably already know that I am on a bit of a quest to stamp out the use of the word normal because, well, you know, I just find that it's really an unhelpful descriptor and it's so subjective. Like, what's normal for me may not be normal for you and vice versa, so why are we even using this word? Anyway, I say all of this because I need to formally apologize to this week's guest for telling him off whenever he happened to use that word in our conversation. So, sorry about that. Sorry. But who is my guest? Well, it is Stephen Griffiths, co-host of the Are the Gays OK podcast. And he came on to talk about moving to Bangkok in his early 20s as a way of escaping his life, just running away from things, which I think is kind of a fantastic thing to do, and everyone should do it at least once in their life. And it was here at Telephone Bar and in other clubs in the gay district that he got the opportunity to try on being gay, like to just see how it felt. And by doing this, he got the opportunity to recognize that it too is normal. Oh, no, I hate using that word. I don't know why I said that. Anyway, should we just get going? So, Bangkok.
Yeah.
Why did you end up there?
And it was very spontaneous. I was 21. I'd just finished university. I was a teacher and I was struggling to get a job, all the typical sort of postgraduate problems. And I had a little bit of money saved up and I knew someone who'd lived in Bangkok and I just decided I was going to go for that and like do a year abroad because I'd never done like a gap year or anything like that. So I booked this ticket to Bangkok one way and I booked onto a course, a TEFL course, and I just kind of went. That's the sort of vanilla answer.
Let's dig a bit deeper. Yeah.
The sort of retrospective answer of what was actually going on. I think I was quite unhappy in the UK at the time. Like I'd only just come out. I wasn't particularly comfortable with being out. And there was a little bit, perhaps, of like pulling an escape hatch and just going somewhere completely new.
Yeah, yeah. So expand on the point you've just made. Wasn't particularly comfortable with being out.
Well, I had a really hard time with being gay when I was younger. I really struggled with it. I didn't want to be. I suppose I say it's common. Like, I know a lot of people experience it. I didn't want to be, you know, I had a girlfriend, I had all those things. Like I was trying very hard to be straight. It wasn't particularly okay within my family for me to be gay. Or at least that's definitely what I'd heard with things people had said about gay people, just sort of typical sort of small things, but that communicate a message that something isn't okay. I suppose my coming out was, I was 20 or 21, around that kind of age when I started telling people. And I suppose I started telling people more because of how unhappy I was, as opposed to I wanted to embrace and accept myself. I'd got to a point where I can't cope with how bad I feel. And some of the stuff I was reading online was suggesting that coming out was going to make it feel better. Which is kind of why I did it. It was more to get away from the pain than it was to go towards anything.
Oh, that's interesting. So, okay, so let's go back a few steps. When did you first say to yourself or have an inkling like, oh, heterosexuality might not be for me?
It's always a really difficult question to answer because, like, I knew there was something different about me from very young. And I think on some level, I knew I was gay, like, from the very beginning. But the denial was kind of so strong that it wasn't knowing. Like, I knew, but I didn't know.
Yeah.
Okay. I think it started to get more intense the older I got. So from about 16 onwards, I kind of knew. But I was clinging on to some hope that perhaps I was going to make heterosexuality work.
Using the tried and tested formula of going out with someone that you're not attracted to?
Yes. A very close friend. We were like best friends, you know, in high school. And we started dating when I was like 17, 18. I think I maybe mistook how close we were with each other for attraction in places.
Yeah.
She was a really lovely girl, you know, we really got on very well. And I kind of think I pinned a lot on it. Like, it became, if I can't make it work with this person, then there's no hope for me.
Oh, that's a lot of pressure to put on yourself.
Yeah, it is. At the time, it felt like the only option. And when I think about it now, like how tormented I was about being gay, it's hard to get back into that headspace because now I'm like, what was all the fuss about? Do you know what I mean? Element of that. Like, it's fine. You know, I'm really happy. But at the time, it was like the worst thing I could imagine. Mm.
And sometimes when you're on a path, you're so committed to staying on that path, right?
Yeah. And there's a lot of risk with coming out that we perhaps don't always talk about. Like, And these things didn't happen, or they didn't happen in the ways I thought, but I was very worried about how my friends were going to treat me if I came out. At school, you know, I was in secondary school in the sort of early 2000s, this shadow of Section 28 still, it wasn't really spoken about. And at that time at school, like, being gay was like the worst thing you could get called. I was very worried about how my friends would treat me. And then the family side of it, I didn't ultimately get like rejected and thrown out of the house. That didn't happen. I'm very fortunate for that. But I did think there was a possibility that was going to happen. Uh-huh. So it's a big roll of the dice coming out. So when you say sort of committing to it, there was a safety element to it in terms of how I was, it's like, I have to do this. Like, it's dangerous not to make this work, you know?
And you talked earlier about the fact that the motivation for coming out and the way that you approached it was, once I do this, I'm going to feel better. How did that inform the way you had those conversations and who you chose to come out to first?
So I'd made a decision, a very sort of pragmatic decision, that I'm going to have to tell people. And the reason I made that decision, so I got drunk one night with my big sister, and she was a lot older than me. We had a very maternal relationship. Well, yeah. Does that work? Well, she was maternal to me. I wasn't maternal to her.
What you meant, yeah.
Yeah, we had that kind of relationship. And I trusted my sister. I was always very close with her. And we were in this pub, and it was like closing up time. I was very drunk, and I started crying. I know, poor me. And I told her I was gay. And we had a big, big conversation about it. And after that, I was like, right, now one... And I trusted her. It wasn't that I thought she was going to tell people.
Yeah.
But it was like, now one person knows, I'm just going to have to tell people. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's going to get out,
like,
now.
The Band-Aid's ripped off. Let's go.
Yeah. So I made a list. I know. I made a list of all the people I thought it was important I told. And then I just started working my way through that list and telling all of these people.
And was there a point system? Was it just a list based on who came out of your head first, or
there was a sort of level of willingness system. So like my dad was like way down the list, like he's the last person I'm going to tell. There were some people who I kind of knew it wasn't going to be as bad with. So like some of my friends who I'd maybe like I knew kind of had an inkling, because I mean at that point we were sort of going to Canal Street sometimes all together, and I'd disappear for hours on end.
Oh, so just for listeners that don't know, Canal Street is the gay street in Manchester.
Yeah, so we'd go on like nights out, and I always wanted to go to Canal Street. and you think, like, I don't know, I thought I was very covert. Do you know what I mean? I thought it was all very subtle.
Hey, everyone, why don't we go to Canal Street?
It's great music, you know? and we'd go, and then there'd be times where, like, I'd disappear for hours and just come up with some weird excuse as to where I'd been. So some of my friends had a bit of an inkling that perhaps all was not quite as heterosexual as I was.
So what were you doing in those few hours? Was it that you were going and like dancing and being around other gays, or you were getting off?
Both. I mean, when I disappeared,
sorry,
it was like
a binary.
I was, you know, disappearing off to a Novotel or something, you know, that kind of vibe.
Ah.
And yeah, and just like, yeah, kissing boys, you know, men, kissing adult men on the dance floor, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. Just expressing sexuality, which I'd not been able to do, you know, because I was very closeted, you know. When you want what you want, you know, like innately,
yeah,
it just kind of burst out when I'd had a drink or when I was in a nightclub or like if there was other gay people around, I just like a moth to a flame, you know.
And so tell me about the conversation that you had with your sister. So you were crying in a pub, closing time, you come out to her. How did that interaction go?
She was very sweet to me. She was very, very sweet with me. Like she told me it would be okay. She said she still loved me. All of the like things you would want someone to say, she said. And there was an element of it feeling like this weight had been lifted, but it was still far from over. And there was still a lot of fear, because my sister had never really been a person I was particularly worried about knowing. Like, she wasn't the problem. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I suppose when you have a secret like that, like I'd had that secret for years and years and years, I was almost a little bit precious about it as well, if I'm honest. Like, it felt very weird that this thing that only I had ever known, that I'd guarded with my life, was now out there and someone else knew it. And I think that's what I mean by now this person knows this isn't some like abstract thing in my head. This is a reality that this person has seen. I suppose it made it so that the only option is to start telling people, because this is true and I know that it's true.
But and so when you say precious about it, was it like a regret that it came out, or?
There was, I suppose, not regret. I mean, I suppose I told her when I was drunk. So there was an element of feeling like I'd not planned to tell her. It felt like it had just sort of slipped out. Regret's the wrong word.
Yeah, sorry. It's a bit clunky.
No, I didn't mean like, how dare you? Like regret isn't... like regret's quite close, but it's like, it was fear more than anything. It felt like this ball had been set in motion. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know if I was quite ready for it to be in motion, but then I didn't know what else to do, you know, like it just felt like it was building momentum and it kind of built this sort of pressure point and it felt like the dam had burst a bit.
But and so it felt like the only logical next step was to start telling other people. You didn't think, oh, I can just take a beat and see how this feels.
No, I didn't think that. I mean, in reality, yeah, of course I could have done that, but I suppose it was so difficult for me emotionally that the only way I could really deal with it was by completely suppressing the emotional side of it and focusing on this is what I'm going to do and I'm going to hope that when I've done all this, I'm going to feel better.
Put a plan around it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't sit with your emotions. Put a plan around it. Oh, this sounds familiar. And then so you've made your way down the list and you talked to a bunch of different people and you came out, but you didn't feel any better.
I mean, yes and no. I felt a little bit better when I'd found out things like when I told my dad, which was obviously a big deal. When I found out I wasn't going to be like ostracized from the family, when I found out that most people were kind of okay with it, like that was a relief, obviously. But I suppose what it didn't necessarily help with was how I felt about it.
Yeah.
And I'd overlooked that I wasn't happy with the fact that I was gay, and I wasn't ready and I wasn't comfortable and I didn't want to be. And all of that stuff was still there. Just everyone knew about it.
We probably don't have enough time to talk about this, but very, very quickly, why were you not happy with being gay?
I suppose, like, it's easy to say now, like, internalized homophobia, but I just didn't think it was okay, you know? I mean, you want to fit in when you're young, don't you? Like, I had a very fixed idea, I suppose, of what being gay meant. Like, and then I wouldn't have called myself effeminate. I wouldn't have called myself camp. And I kind of thought that was the only way you could do it. And it was, there was a little bit of, not mourning, but like more the idea of what my future was going to look like and realizing it wasn't going to look that way.
Yeah, okay. So like reconciliation with what you had always thought your future was going to be with what it possibly could now be.
Yeah, and I, like I said, I grew up in Manchester, but I grew up in kind of a small suburb of Manchester. So I didn't really know many gay people either. And there wasn't, even then, there wasn't kind of the representation that there is today. I suppose it was just, it felt like I was something that I wasn't supposed to be. And like a lot of the advice I got, like well-meaning, like, oh, you're going to have a harder life because of this. Like I used to hear that quite a lot. So I was scared, I suppose.
And so then you created a plan to run away.
Yes. I did. And I don't regret it. It was the right thing to me.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. And I'm not, sorry, I'm not even implying that that was a bad thing.
But it was, there was an element of running away of like, I can't cope with this. Like, I'm not ready. And I think when you come out, like, the troublesome thing about it is like, I hadn't earned my stripes as like a gay person by then, if you know what I mean. Like, I hadn't built any kind of thick skin. I didn't know how to handle people commenting on it. I wasn't sure enough in it to be able to handle some of the things that come with it. And it was just too much for me to have people making comments or having to defend it. You know, I wasn't able to have those arguments because I wasn't confident in it.
And it, having those conversations defending, was that a real or imagined scenario?
It was real. It was real. I did have some of those conversations with people.
Wow.
Some worse than others, but like there was one person in the family particularly was saying quite a lot of stuff that was very, very negative that I wouldn't tolerate today, you know, that I wouldn't put up with at all today. But I remember this was kind of happening again in a pub. And most of my family were there and they were saying all this stuff about me being gay, being a pervert, all of these things, you know.
And no one defended you?
No, no one defended me. Everyone kind of laughed as if it was a joke.
Oh.
And I wasn't confident enough in it to be able to, like, fight back.
Yeah,
So stuff like that, I suppose, was probably a contributor to why I just wanted to leave and leave my problems behind, you know, like go somewhere where people didn't know me, where there wasn't this expectation, where I could figure it out, I suppose.
Yeah. And was that the conscious plan then? I'm going to go and figure this out. Or was it just, I need to be somewhere else. I'm going to be somewhere else.
I think the conscious element was like, I need to be somewhere else.
Yeah.
But underlaying it and driving it was, I think, this idea that I need to go somewhere where I can just be myself without all of this baggage and all of this confrontation, whatever you want to call it, without all of this. Like, I just need to be somewhere where I can just be and figure stuff out.
Yeah. And so landing in Bangkok, arriving, figuring out like where you're going to live, what everything is going to be in your everyday life. What sticks out most in terms of memories from those days? Like, where was your head at?
Still very conflicted. And this is, I suppose, we'll get into it. What ended up happening, so I did this course that really softened all of that, because as part of that, like, I had accommodation for a month. I was doing this course for a month. It gave me this focus for the first month I was there.
And this course was teaching English as a second language.
Yeah, that's right. So I kind of just arrived there and I was very, very scared, as you can imagine. Like, I was 21 in this foreign country where I didn't know anyone. I didn't know anything. I didn't know how anything worked. And everything was very overwhelming. I was getting lost all the time. It was hotter than I could have possibly imagined it being. It was very, very overwhelming. And this course was like this grounding place for that, because it was like, I know on Monday at 9 o'clock I go to this place and I know I'm staying here. Mm-hmm. And that was like a something. But what happened was, and you've not asked this question, but this is what kind of ended up happening. I went onto this course, and the first day, at the end of the course, there was this lad, this Australian guy who was like 30, and he was talking to me because we were probably the youngest people there. And he was like, oh, do you want to go out for a drink? I'm going to go to Soy Cowboy. And I presume you know what Soy Cowboy is, or maybe not. I don't know. Like, Soy Cowboy is this part of Bangkok, like the red light district, effectively.
Okay.
Where it's sort of all of these, they call them girl bars, where people pay and girls come home with them. And it's awful. I mean, it's just part of what the culture is there, but it's a very sleazy place. So he was obviously just assuming that I was straight, and also apparently assuming that I was a sleaze.
Yeah.
You know? And I like to think even if I was straight, that's not what I'd want to be doing. So I went for this drink with him, and he was like wanting to bring girls back with him. And I was like, oh my God, this is a mess. Like, I don't know what to do. So I ended up saying, like, oh, I've got a girlfriend in England. Uh-huh. And I think what it did was it made me realize, when I look back on it, it's like you take your problems with you wherever you go. Do you know what I mean? I think I thought I could just go and have this clean slate there, and I was going to arrive there and just be gay and everything was going to be fine. And that's not what happened. You know, I arrived there a few months only really out of the closet, and the first sort of opportunity to like test that, I went straight back into the closet, and that went on for like a year of just being back in Bangkok. Yeah,
but being in the closet, or just not doing anything about your sexuality, like, is more, there a distinction there?
Like, that was more my like closeted era. It was very, very strange, because like on one continent everybody knew I was gay.
Uh-huh.
I knew I was gay. And yet I was actively living this lie in Bangkok to everybody I knew that I was straight, which sounds maybe similar to what was happening in England. But I think the thing that had changed was like the denial had gone. Like, I understood that I was gay, and this was just an active lie at this point, you know?
Yeah. But the other thing that was different is that you didn't actually have any pre-existing relationships with any of these people that you were lying to.
Yeah, that's true. And that's an interesting point, because I never really think about that. I suppose it speaks to it being me and my problem at that point, you know?
Uh-huh.
That, yeah, I'd done the hard bit, if that's what you want to call it, of telling all the people who were important to me. And it did help in some ways, but what it didn't help with was how I felt, you know, that I still thought being gay was this bad thing that was going to cause people to not want to be around me or to be friends with me or to care about me.
So it wasn't that you were presenting as straight just to make situations easy and not have to go into a whole thing explaining. It was that you thought people would prefer you as a heterosexual.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a slight oversimplification, but yeah, I think that's close.
Ah, okay. And that happened for a year?
Yeah.
Wow. So were you living like this other life at the time and going to gay bars? Or were you just like, no, I'm just going to have dinner and go to bed?
Yeah, no, I was living this complete double life. I mean, now I look back at it really sort of fondly and I kind of think it's quite cute. But at the time, it was quite tormented.
It's like
you're
being a spy. Yeah.
Yeah, it was. And I suppose, like, I just carried on with similar behaviour I'd done in England, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, in England, I'd go to Canal Street with my friends and I'd disappear off. And I suppose what transitioned in Bangkok is I found out where the gay area was. Someone mentioned it to me. And I started frequenting it alone. Mm-hmm. But in secret, you know, this sort of covert thing. So like when I'd go out with my friends who were all straight, we'd go to like, I nearly said, no, I'm going to still say the normal, but like how I'd have framed it then,
you know,
like the normal places. And then when I was alone, I'd sort of slip off to the gay bars.
Ah. And were any of them suspicious?
My friends, I don't think, you know, I mean, maybe I'm deluded, maybe they are, but I really don't think so. I was very convincing with it. I was very committed to it as well. Do you know what I mean? There was a girl.
Okay.
There was a girl. She was very, very sweet. And we were like best friends. And there was a idea outside of our friendship that we were like a will they, won't they type situation. Uh-huh. And I played into it a little bit because I was like, this is like my cover. And I never did anything with this girl. Do you know what I mean? It was never that, but she acted as a...
You just raised her hopes and made her think that... I have
since apologized to her for... But yeah, I raised her hopes. And used her. Like, if we're going to put a fine point, I used her, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, my secret was more important than her well-being there, you know? And I probably got in the way of her meeting other people in places there because... I liked this idea that people thought we could be a couple because it was my cover, you know?
So who were these straight people? Why would you even be friends with straight people? Sorry to any straight people listening.
They were just like people I worked with. Just, I don't know, just people who I suppose I thought were, and I'm going to use the word again, but like normal, which is at that point, all I really wanted was to fit into this mold. And they were nice people for the most part. Like a few of them weren't, you know, like me and the Australian guy who wanted to go to Soy Cowboy didn't stay in touch, you know, but some of them were very sweet people. But I was just so worried. I just wanted to be accepted so badly, I think, that I was willing to conform. And I don't know, you underestimate, I think, at that, the younger ages, like how important it is to fit in and how important those social groupings are and wanting to feel a part of something. And like I said, in Manchester, like I didn't know any gay people at all. So it was kind of scary, you know, the idea of being friends with...
Well, so in these situations in Manchester when you were like disappearing and going and dancing or going and like with people, did you not then talk to any of them?
No. No, I didn't.
Okay.
I'm going to be really honest about it now. Like, I suppose I saw being gay as this sordid thing, you know, this dirty secret. So I treated it in a way that was very, very sordid and reinforced that. So the only sexual encounters I would have would be in hotels, in nightclub toilets. Like, it was that kind of vibe. And I wasn't interested in who they were.
But there was never a time when they were like, oh, that was really good. Can I give you my number?
I suppose whenever they gave me their number, I just never called them, you know? Like, I didn't want... Because sober me couldn't engage with it at all.
Interesting, interesting. And this going to Bangkok, and I know it's not, like, as neat as this necessarily, but going to Bangkok and being like, okay, this is my fresh start. This is where I get to be a homosexual. And then immediately retreating into this closet... I don't know if I'm making a point here. I don't know why. I don't know. It's really interesting. It's super interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I think like obviously I've thought about it a lot, like in adulthood, because I did come out again in Bangkok to all these people like a year later. Mm-hmm. And that's where like I feel like my coming out process was like complete. And then I really started to like learn to live authentically. But I think it was... I needed that time. Like, I needed to get to a place with coming out where I wasn't doing it to try and end some kind of pain. I was doing it because I was gay. I knew I was gay and I was okay with it. And that's what that year let me do. Like, I got to rewrite it almost, and I got to come out when I was ready.
And just that extra time to process it properly.
Yeah, I think so. And to take the pressure off it a bit and... to get used to it, you know, like I had enough time for my family. Things were starting to settle down, like when I'd speak to them, and they were far enough away that it wasn't an issue. Like I had enough time to learn what it was to be gay, to like, and go into these gay bars in Bangkok were very healing for me in a lot of ways as well. And I got to meet other people who were gay and start to become friends with them. And all of that I needed to be able to accept who I was.
Okay, so let's talk a bit about the healing that happened in bars.
Yeah.
Shall we go to the telephone bar?
We shall. So telephone is the oldest, well, it was. It was the oldest gay bar in Bangkok, I believe. It's been there for about 30 years. So with that comes a reputation of it being known. And so how I found telephone was a karaoke thing, a karaoke night they used to do. And this there was a girl who was in Bangkok who I'd known in England. So she was this one person who, like, worlds collided, you know. She knew I was gay.
Yeah.
And she was in Bangkok. And she invited me to telephone to this karaoke bar. And it gave me the sort of signpost, right, this is where it is that I can go. And through going there, I found out where the space was, you know. So it was a whole street. Have you been to Bangkok? Or?
No.
There's the main street. It's called Soi Fur. And all of the gay bars are on this street in Silom. And telephone was sort of right at the end. So it was kind of my gateway to the rest of the world of where all these gay bars were. So I'd gone with her this first time. And, you know, we were doing karaoke. And, like, she'd invited some of her friends. And she had a lot of gay friends. And I just had a really nice time there, you know, singing Celine Dion or whatever, you know, like.
Oh, okay. So that was going to be a follow-up question. What is your karaoke song of choice?
Now it's No Scrubs by TLC.
Okay.
But that took me a while to find
with
my niche.
With the rap or without the rap?
With the rap.
Okay, of course. Brilliant. Fantastic. I was going to have
I was
to
very committed to it.
Yeah, okay.
So, yeah, so I found telephone. And there used to be three floors to telephone. And, like, at the bottom, it was quite chill. In the middle, it was kind of like a club. And at the top, it was this members-only karaoke place.
Okay, so then let's go back to first impressions. You have been invited here. You know it's a karaoke night. This is like it. This is your first time to go to a gay bar. Tell me about how it felt walking in.
There was like a furtive element because it was like a secret that I was going there. But then it was like going in and feeling, right, I can relax. You know, I can breathe. I don't have to try. You know, I don't have to try. I can just come here and I can be myself and, like, no one's going to care if I sing power ballads or, like, Britney or
sorry to interrupt you, but do you know how judgmental gay people are?
Well, I do now. But I didn't then, you know, I didn't then. And the gay people I was with, so her friends, like, were very sweet with me. Uh-huh. And because, like, as judgmental as gays are, like, we love someone fresh out of the closet, you know. I think it's so relatable and, like...
Oh, so not in a predatory way.
Well, that too. That, I mean, that did, these people know, but, like, they were kind of the really nice side of someone fresh out of the closet. Like, when they found out that people didn't know I was gay, they rallied around me, you know.
Aww.
And they're like, why? You know, and at the time, it felt combative, but I can see it now. They wanted to, like, it's okay, you know, come with us, you know. Yeah. And I suppose that was the first time I was seeing gay people in a healthy, positive way as well, mm-hmm. because it was like this group of gay friends and they all seemed nice and normal. And it wasn't like...
Oh, there's that word again.
I suppose it is. Because I suppose I did see it as abnormal prior, you know. I did see it as this aberration that I shouldn't be.
But what is normal?
Well, now I am aware that there is no such thing. But I suppose I'm using the word so much because I'm being in the mindset I was in, where the most important thing in the world to me was to kind of fit in and conform. Yeah. I look sometimes at some of the stuff I wrote when I was, like, younger and trying to deal with coming out and being gay.
Aww.
And normal was definitely the word, you know. I don't want to be gay, I want to be normal. Like, that was what I thought, that's how it was. And then going back to what I said before, about when I used to go to Manchester and go to these gay bars, I wasn't behaving in a way that was what I would sort of say normal, you know, because I was disappearing off. I was running into nightclub toilets with people I didn't know. That's the view of gay people that I had.
Yeah.
And what I suppose I mean by normal is perhaps safe sometimes. Like, I felt safe is probably a kind of way of saying it. Like, I'm going to jump back for a second. One thing my dad did say to me not long after I'd come out was that I needed to be careful of predatory homosexuals. And I'll never forget it that he said that to me. So I think my guard was kind of always up, you know, because I was scared. And what I mean by these people being normal is, I suppose, I felt safe with them. I didn't feel like they were trying to take advantage of me. When I'd said I was still in the closet, they were so, so sweet to me and kind and, like, trying to help me. Mm-hmm. And they weren't living this sort of seedy life, which is what I'd always, I suppose, termed it as. Like, they were just not, they were just nice people, you know? And it was important that I got to see that a little bit.
Yeah. And so after this first night, going there, belting out your Celine Dion hits, was the lid off the box? And did you then start exploring the rest of the scene? Or was it one step forward, two steps back?
No, the lid was off. I suppose the only thing that was off about it was that it was in secret. And yeah, that I used to predominantly go either with this girl and her friends or by myself. And sort of typical stuff. It'd be like I'd go out with my friends and then at the end of the night, they'd all go home and I'd go there. Like,
oh, well, it's getting late. You better leave. And then...
No, or I'd just go there on my own, like after work sometimes, and just go sit at the bar and like wait for people to come and talk to me. Mm-hmm. And it was just getting to do the things that I'd never been able to do. Like, of just going to gay bars, you know, and meeting people and not necessarily just always being there hammered off my face, going off with random strangers, mm-hmm. but just going there because I liked being there and I liked seeing other people who were gay, just being able to be safe somewhere.
Yeah.
And that year was characterized by that. I'd have this life with my friends and then this secret life where I was going to the gay bars and trying it on, I suppose, you know. And when I say, I don't mean trying it on as in causing trouble, but just trying it on, you know, yeah, like trying to wear being gay and edging towards being okay with it.
What was it about those spaces that allowed that to happen?
So I'm going to use the word normal again. Uh-huh. I suppose it normalized, you know, because I grew up in this suburb of Manchester where Canal Street was sort of far enough away that you couldn't go all the time.
Yeah.
And I would never been in a place to be able, I was never like a village gay anyway, you know, I was never.
Is that said with judgment?
Perhaps with a little jealousy, if I'm really honest. Oh, like okay. A little jealousy that it took me so long, all that stuff we say to ourselves, because I was quite, by this point, I'm 22, do you know what I mean? But I suppose I'd never been in a safe space. Do you know what I mean? I'd never been in gay-only spaces.
Yeah.
So there'd always been a heterosexual majority, and I was kind of the only gay. So I suppose going to those spaces where the majority of people were gay, or the people who weren't gay who were there were like the minority and safe,
yeah,
helped me to realize that there was a part of the world, at least, where I was normal. There are other people who are like me.
Yeah.
And as much as I don't like the word now, it helped me to feel less abnormal.
I'm going to ask this, and there's kind of lots of layers of presumptions in this question. So just swap me away if it doesn't resonate or if it doesn't align with your experiences. What can often happen when people are still struggling with their identity and their sexuality is that they can go to these spaces and yes, they can be surrounded by others, but there's still a us and them mentality, or me and them, I guess, mentality where you're like, oh, I'm not like other gays.
Well presumed. yeah, that was true. Well, no, it wasn't true. I was like them, but that was what was going on in my head at parts. But I'd say a little bit later than that, that was kind of the next stage. Once I was out
fascinating.
And I was gay, I was kind of like the gay who doesn't like other gays, you know. I'm fine, you know, they might be this, but I'm okay. Like all my friends, like I had a load of straight friends. So that did creep in. But I think in the era we're talking about now, it was more being at the like sweet shop window almost, like being on the outside looking in at that point.
Yeah. And very quickly, like, the big shtick about Telephone Bar is that all of the tables had a phone on them, right?
Yeah.
So how did that work? And did anyone ring you? Okay, so, yeah, sorry, I haven't explained that very well for people who are listening. So there's a telephone on every table, and you can ring other people at different tables in the bar and talk to them.
Yeah, you can. And that was only on the, I think it was like, it was the second floor or the first floor you could do that. And it was very, very sweet, you know. And it was actually, for a baby gay like me, who was just out there, it was actually really helpful not having to, like, hustle, you know, like...
Or just wait for them to come to you by ringing your phone.
Yeah, like just sit there and like the phone rings and it's nice, you know, you get that little flutter and then you talk to someone and it's just like a really lovely icebreaker.
But what happens, like, so you don't know who they are when they ring and you pick up the phone and then you're like, hi, and then you talk to them and then you're looking around the room to see who it is. What if you're like, ugh, no. How do you end the conversation?
Well, I don't know if I should say this or not, but at the time where I was utilizing the telephones, I didn't say no very often. So I don't really know.
Okay.
I was very, like, sexually repressed, I suppose, because of this heterosexual life I was living everywhere else. I was mostly just excited that people called. And it was like an element of people would ring and they'd maybe send you a drink over as part of that. And it wasn't like, you know, you weren't signing a contract, you know. And at that point, I suppose I was all about exploration. So most of the time it was like they'd want to send you a drink and they'd want to come and sit with you for a little bit. So it wasn't like you were, you know, I booked us a hotel room. You know, it wasn't that vibe. It was just like, let's talk. And then it would evolve from there. So it was more...
No, but even, like, so reinforcing what I said before about gays being judgmental, what if you just look at them and you're like, oh, no?
I suppose there's an element here of, like, it being slightly different culturally, perhaps, in that Telephone was one of the biggest and busiest gay bars in Bangkok, but it was nothing like the level of busy that you'd experience in Canal Street. So there was still an intimacy to it. And because of that, it was almost a little bit friendlier than some of the experiences I've had in, like, gay bars in the UK, where it is very, very judgmental. And obviously there are times where you perhaps aren't attracted to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But I never experienced an interaction like that happening particularly cruelly. It always seemed to just... be worked out. And a lot of the time as well, I was in there on, like, Tuesday nights, Wednesday nights. I just wanted to go home with someone. So it just, do you know what I mean? I don't know if I'm saying that very well, but it wasn't.
Oh, okay. So what you're saying then is that I would be the judgmental mean person if I ever went to Telephone Bar and everyone else would be lovely and nice.
I mean, there'd be a few more of you as well, I imagine. But I think as well, it's like, it was a gimmick. Do you know what I mean? Like, people didn't take it as seriously as people are perhaps imagining. Like, it wasn't like a speed dating night. And, like, a lot of the time you'd go and the phones wouldn't ring. Do you know what I mean? I think it was part of the tradition that they'd always been there. And part of it as well, I like to think it was to make it a little bit easier for people like me who perhaps weren't as sure of themselves to be able to start those connections. Because it is difficult at the beginning if you're, and I was always quite shy, like shy naturally anyway, but then shy in gay bars, very shy. And it was a little crutch, you know, to make it a little bit easier.
So then my follow-up question, did you ever actively ring anyone else or did you wait for them to contact you?
Mostly, I would wait for people to ring me.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I've dialed a few numbers in my life.
Ooh, so what would, like, particularly appeal to you and who would you ring? What would be the kind of person you'd ring?
I liked a pretty boy. I liked Americans as well. I don't know why. I had a big thing about American, sort of the all-American boy type thing.
Okay.
I've got a guy in my head now. He was called Brian, I think.
Brian with an I or Brian with a Y?
With a Y.
Ah, okay.
I won't say his surname, but he had he had a very memorable name. He was the first gay guy that I really, really liked there. And I suppose that was a sign of, like, me changing, because before then, if I'm really honest, it didn't matter. Like, it didn't matter. I just wanted to do something with a man, you know? It was kind of that.
Yeah.
And as I was becoming a little more experienced, becoming a little bit more okay, I was starting to develop a type. And there was this boy called Brian, and I did ring him. Aww. He sat on another table with his friends, and I rang, and I, like, asked if he wanted to come for a drink, and we had a drink. We went upstairs to the karaoke bit of the bar. We went upstairs there uh-huh. together, and we were, like, dancing and kissing a little bit. We went into the toilets together. He gave me his number. And he was only on holiday. He was only there for a couple of weeks, but we had a really sweet... And he was a lot more okay with being gay than I was still. You know, he was a little bit older than me. He was very confident and very patient. You know, I think that's the thing that I really needed, was people who could be patient with me. And I mean, that's probably not very attractive outwardly. Do you know what I mean? For the other person.
But what do you mean by that? Like, to take things slow?
To take things slow, and I suppose some elements of reassurance as well, is what I kind of needed. So I'm going to be quite blunt about this now.
Yeah.
So to have sex with somebody was kind of fine. You know, I could do that because I was quite detached from the whole thing and it was just over there, you know? But the difference with this guy was I liked him and I wanted to get to know him and those things. And that's where I probably needed the patience more, because there was still quite a lot of self-loathing. There was still quite I had a lot of issues around it still.
Yeah.
And he was very, like, reassuring with me, you know? And, like, I think I was... You know, the predatory thing, I was so scared of, like, being vulnerable with someone. Like, that's where I needed the patience, that he wasn't going to, like, screw me over, you know, that he wasn't going to have sex with me and never call me again. Like, that kind of thing, I suppose, is where, I mean, I needed the patience and the compassion, I suppose.
But he was only there for a few weeks.
Yeah, he was, like, traveling. But it was, like, it was also that, like, led to one of the first, like, sober interactions I ever had with... Well, not ever had with a gay person, but, like, a suitor, you know, with, like, a potential...
A gentleman caller.
Yeah, like, where we went out for, like, a coffee the next day, and it was...
Was it normal?
Yeah, it was more than normal, you know, it was nice, you know, it was... I started to be able to see a future where, like, oh, maybe I'll just, like, have a boyfriend one day and everything's going to be fine. Do you know what I mean? That being gay wasn't just, like, a sexual preference. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't just about my sexuality, that it was everything, you know? Like, it was a connection and it was relationships. And I suppose, like, that all was not lost. Do you know? I'm struggling to wrap words around what I'm trying to say, I think.
But it's like you could have the life that you'd always imagined. Oh, that sounded just so gross and cheesy. Sorry.
that there was a life available to me still.
Yeah.
You know, and that thing of, like, diversity within it, that, like, I could be any kind of gay person that I wanted to be, you know, and that it didn't just have to be. I'd always, like I said before, I'd always seen gay as this, like, sordid thing. And because of that, I always treated it that way. And I think this opened my eyes to the fact that it didn't have to be that if I didn't want it to be that, you know? Like, if I want to have a boyfriend and only be intimate with that person, then that is okay. And there's no judgment to people who don't want that, but recognizing, like, I get to decide how I want to exist in this world and I get to decide what I want. And I think previously I felt like everything I sort of imagined for my future was kind of off the table. Mm. And this guy, even though it was only a couple of weeks, he kind of put it back on the table for me.
And once it's back on the table, how does that show up in your everyday life?
Most commonly just in how I was perceiving myself and how I invited the being gay in. Whereas I suppose before, it always felt like there was a gay part of me, you know, like this thing that was driving me that I couldn't change. I think I, like, started to integrate it a little bit more. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was, instead of being a part of me, it just became part of me. Oh god, that was awful.
It stopped being part of you and started being part of you. Is that what?
Like it stopped being like a part of me. Like it used to feel.
Oh, is the word like apart?
Apart, yeah.
And it, a part.
Yeah. In my head, this sounds beautiful. But I think it felt external almost. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, it felt like this thing that was a very distinct part of myself.
Yeah.
That I didn't necessarily want to be, and it was something I was kind of working around. And that part would only come out when I was in a gay bar, you know? And it would come out in ways where I'd be like, who's that guy? Who's that guy? Who's that guy? Who's that guy? Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And it sort of shifted to being a more like central part of who I was and recognizing that it wasn't this thing that could only be let out in space. It started to become like, right, I'm just a gay person. And that's okay, you know? Yeah. I don't know if that's making sense or not.
No, yeah, it does. And sorry to lightly rip you there, but like you started integrating that into every part of your life.
Yeah, I think that was the beginning of that starting to happen, yeah, of it just becoming something that was okay and me accepting that I was just a gay person. And like, I suppose, you know, you said before about being sort of outside of it, you know, and thinking like, oh, it's good for them, but I'm not like that. Like, I think it started to allow me into the world and, like, becoming more a part of it, I suppose.
Yeah. And so at some point you leave Bangkok? Sorry, but I know you do because you're not in Bangkok now, but, like, so you left Bangkok.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was there for 6 years in the end. And so at the end of my first year there, I came out again to everybody. And then I really started living authentically in Bangkok, you know, and I had some gay friends and like we'd go to like Soi 4 together. And like it just became a lot more fun, you know, like it became too much fun actually in reality. But yeah, I did end up 6 years after that. I came back home. And
wait, too much fun. What does that mean?
I got very, very addicted to alcohol and very, very addicted to drugs whilst I was there, largely in those spaces. And it got pretty weird, you know, it got pretty dark for me there towards the end. So I had like a sort of sweet spot of a couple of years when I was sort of 22 to 24, where I was just being gay and everyone knew and it wasn't a problem and it was like, oh my god, this is amazing, you know, like the excitement of like I'm doing it, you know, like I'm living this life, you know, and I feel okay. And I got very carried away because so much of gay spaces or queer spaces are in bars and it is such an ingrained part of the culture, I think, like drinking and taking drugs. And I suppose, as much as like we're talking about it quite lightly, the experience I'd had of coming out, as much as like, you know, like we're laughing about parts of it, was very, very difficult for me. You know, it was very, very painful. There was a lot of shame. There was like traumatic element to the whole thing. And I think when you take a person who's had that level of shame and trauma and then throw them into a world that is very hedonistic, where like alcohol is available, drugs are available, sex is available, it can just become this perfect storm for addiction to take hold, because I wanted to experience everything, you know, I wanted to have fun, you know, it'd been so like dark and pressured and stressful for so long that I just wanted to let loose.
Yeah.
And I let a little too loose, you know, it got a grip of me.
And so was you leaving Bangkok because of that or part of the reason of that or?
Yeah, it was. Well, it was and it wasn't. I got sober in Bangkok in the end when I was 26. And I was there for a year sober after that. And then I went back home. So I'd say like my addiction didn't like send me home, but my recovery did.
So having had that 6 years in Bangkok and then going home in your late 20s, who was the person that got off the plane?
An incredibly different one from the one who departed, you know. I I still had a way to go with a lot of stuff, you know, like, but I was a sober person, you know. I had an awareness of my mental health that I'd never had before. I was gay. Everyone knew I was gay, and there was never any idea that I was going to pretend to be otherwise. I would say I was still vulnerable in a lot of ways, but I had a strength that had been hitherto missing.
Oh, good. You said the word hitherto.
I know. Who said hitherto? For me, apparently, because I'm so cultured. Thus, yeah, that had been missing previously. And yeah, I suppose I was wanting to build up, because I came back to the UK because I wanted to stop running, you know. I felt like Bangkok had been this place I'd gone to run away from all of the things in England, all of the pressures. And I wanted to go and face it all, you know. I wanted to stand tall in sort of who I was in England and prove that I could exist here if I wanted to.
And did you?
Yeah, I did. And a lot of additional stuff happened for me there as well. And ironically, it was only when I was sober that I started to properly have a group of gay friends. Like I've just said, so many gay spaces are centered around drinking. And I suppose I'd always really wanted to like build this friendship circle of gay people, LGBT people, people who understood me. And I actually ended up getting that through being sober. And yeah, I went to a lot of support groups around addiction, and I went to a lot of LGBT specific ones. And that helped me to really build a community around myself that I'd not had previously. And now like 90% of my friends are gay. Do you know what I mean? And I suppose there's such a journey in that, from being, you know, the gay who doesn't like other gays, like the person who thought it was the worst thing in the world, to like an active part of the community, you know. So yeah, I did prove I could exist here and build a life for myself. And it's just, I think sometimes we forget like what a long journey it can be from being that sort of gay teenager, that gay little kid who wanted to be anything but gay, who wanted to be like normal, to realizing like what life can look like, what life can be, like what kind of person you can be in the world. And as much as a lot of it was painful, like I don't regret the journey I had to take to get to where I am.
So then, if we can end on high cheese, let's go back in time. So let's imagine that you are in Telephone Bar right now and you're like 22, 23, and the phone rings on your table and you pick it up and the person on the other end is you from the future. What advice do you think he would give you?
I think I'd want to tell him that everything is going to be okay. You know, that you are normal, like whatever that means. There's nothing wrong with you. And that you're probably going to get lost for a while trying to figure it all out. It's going to be difficult. You're not going to know where to turn. But where you're going to land is going to be okay. It's going to be more than okay. And to like keep the faith. And that one day, this thing that you hate about yourself, being gay, is going to be one of the things that you like the most about yourself. And this is a long phone call. I'd have put the phone down by now. And that you are going to be able to help people as a result of these experiences. Like one day you're going to be able to talk to someone who's struggling with coming out, and you're going to know what to say because you found it hard too. And that's where we get strength from. And then I'd put the phone down and say, do you want a vodka and Coke?
Do you have any memories of Telephone Bar, or maybe clubbing from your own queer scene that you want to share? Well, if you do, I would love to hear all about it, so why not get in touch? I want to create the biggest online record of people's memories and stories of queer clubbing, but I need your help. Go to lostspacespodcast.com and find the section Share a Lost Space to tell me all about what it is you got up to. You can also find me on Facebook and Instagram, where my handle is Lost Spaces Pod. Find out more about Stephen by listening to his podcast, Are the Gays Okay?, which is a show all about queer mental health, and it's available to stream right now wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find out more about him by visiting his website, swgcounselling.co.uk, where you can find out all about his counselling services. If you enjoyed this episode, I would really appreciate if you subscribe, leave a review on your podcast platform, or just tell other people who you think might be interested in giving it a little listen too. My name's Kay Anderson, and you've been listening to Lost Spaces.